I didn't want to interact with her at all. I just wanted her to know I was there supporting her. But when her family spotted me in the crowd and made a beeline for me during the game, I was completely shocked. "Oh my God, Soph, hi!" Her sister swept me into a tight hug, far from the reaction I expected to receive after recent events. "Soph, we've missed you," added her mum, following closely behind. I had purposely tried to stay away from these people, made sure I wasn't to be seated anywhere near them. This was her family, and I had broken up with her. I had no right to insert myself into their dynamic, not that day, not ever. But they were insistent. "Why are you sitting over there by yourself? Come and sit with us in the family section." They all knew perfectly well what had happened between us, but they were such beautiful, accepting, non-judgmental people. Their approach was, if she knows you're here and she's okay with it, then we're okay with it too. They didn't ask any questions. They didn't see it as any of their business. "Come on, Soph." I didn't want to be rude, but no, I couldn't sit with them. I couldn't. I did. The pride I felt as I sat there, surrounded by her family, watching as she played, pounded in my chest. Her team was vying for a spot in the games, and she was in the thick of it, helping them take home the win. It was incredible. More than once during the match, she looked up, and I could have sworn she'd picked my face out in the crowd. I didn't know how that would even be possible, and yet, at the same time, of course she did, because that was just us. It's how we were. Magnetized, connected on some other level. We could never quit each other, no matter how hard we tried, because there was an invisible string drawing us together that could never be broken. The game wrapped up and they were standing around taking photos. My back was to the field and Floss started bouncing around in my arms, waving, "Mummy, Mummy, look!" I turned around and it was her, hands on hips, staring up at me. The world froze as our eyes met. Sounds cliched, but when this woman looked at me, when she looked into my eyes, I melted. It didn't matter that we hadn't seen each other or even spoken in weeks. It didn't matter that the last words we'd said were in anger. It didn't matter that I'd dumped her, taken up with someone else. In that instant she looked into my eyes, I was hers again. This wasn't a one-off. It's how it had always been between us. With one look, my soul was hers. She would look deeper into me than anyone else ever had, ever could, and she had my heart. "I hate you, but I am so glad you're here," her expression seemed to say as she held my gaze for what felt like an eternity. From that moment, I was gone. Game over. She jumped the fence and came up into the crowd, something she never did, and made her way to me. "Hey, how you going?" Our first words in nearly 2 months. "Good, good, great game." We chatted for a moment, nothing more than small talk, before she was taken away for the obligatory post-match photos with family and fans, but she kept looking over, checking that I hadn't left. She wants me here. I didn't need to be by her side. It was enough for her to feel my presence, to know I was supporting her. But time was ticking on and I had to get Florence to bed. I made my way over to say goodbye. "Thanks for coming," she said, leaning in to give me a hug. "What are you doing now?" "Oh, nothing, just taking this one home. She needs to get to bed," I replied, bouncing Florence on my waist. "Cool, well, I've just got to have a shower, pack my bag. I could probably be there in about half an hour." It wasn't a request. It was a statement. It was presumptuous, so arrogant to assume that I'd allow it, and I fucking loved it. This unshakable confidence was one of the things I loved most about this woman, and I found myself agreeing in spite of myself. An hour later, Floss was fast asleep, and the woman was at my doorstep, a bottle of my favourite wine in hand. We talked for hours. We always had this uncanny ability to pick up where we left off like nothing had ever happened. She always felt like home, and I don't know if that was a great thing or a terrible one, but it made it very easy to slip back into the feeling that we were girlfriends and do so with very little guilt about the girl I was seeing back in Melbourne who thought I was spending the night alone. How could something that felt so right possibly be wrong? I knew what I was doing was morally and ethically wrong, but I'd done commitment. I'd been married. I'd spent my entire 20s changing nappies. In this moment of my life, I was selfish because I felt like I deserved to be selfish. So when I sat up with this woman drinking wine and talking until 7 o'clock in the morning, there was no guilt, nothing weighing on my conscience, because in that moment, I was exactly where I needed to be. Chapter 18. After the qualifiers in early 2020, my love life was finally in a good place. After months of anguish, the intense highs and lows were over, and I'd come out the other side at last, with my love by my side. I'd called things off with the beautiful blonde in Melbourne once and for all, a relief after the agonising back and forth I'd been doing to her. I certainly hadn't taken any pleasure in hurting her over and over again. Now my girlfriend, my interstate girl, invited me away on a holiday with her family in early March. We were going to go to Fiji, something we were both so excited about, though COVID-19 forced us to change the destination. This invitation felt like a huge step, given how important her family are to her. She's travelled the world since she was 16, so hasn't always seen them much, and I could tell by the way she watched me interact with them that it made her happy. "You really fit in here," her brother told me, not having a clue how much that made my heart sing. "Do you two ever talk about having kids?" The question was unexpected. After all, we hadn't been together that long in the scheme of things. But yes, we had talked about it, more than once. I could see her mum as a grandmother to our babies, her sister as an auntie to my kids. I saw her brother as my best man in our wedding. I could picture our life together so clearly. "Yeah, we've talked about it," I replied with a smile, keeping the name we'd already picked out to myself. I love that. That makes me really happy. Her brother is her idol, so the fact that he felt so comfortable asking me about having a serious future with his sister, for me, it was a sign that we were meant to be. But I also know now that my ability to see our life planned out in such precise, beautiful detail scared the hell out of her. With her approval, I shared photos of us together on my Instagram, ones her sister had taken of us together, knowing I would be revealing for the first time in a public forum that I was dating a woman. She commented with love hearts on my post, writing, "Love you, babe." And so, just like that, I went public with not only our relationship, but also, for the very first time, my sexuality. While there'd been speculation in the media for more than a year around my and Jared's split, it hadn't been confirmed. I hadn't ever come out. So this was a monumental moment for me in terms of owning my newfound identity. The media, of course, had a field day and it was all over the headlines. Sophie Keisha holidays with new girlfriend. I hate to think what those stories must have done to my ex, who I'd only been with a few weeks earlier. But for the first time in what felt like forever, I was content and I was happy. I was in love and I was loved too. I'd chosen to put myself first, and while I hated the pain I'd caused along the way, I knew I'd done the right thing by myself. A few days after that blissful week with her family, she was set to play a grand final in Melbourne. I couldn't have been more excited to see my girl on the field again, this time in my own hometown, but there was a bit of urgency to it too. We both knew she could be called up to go back overseas at any moment, and it was likely coming in the next couple of weeks, so I didn't want to miss a single chance to spend time with her before that day came. "I can't wait to come watch you," I texted her a couple of nights ahead of the game. "You don't have to come. Let's please not make a big deal of it," was the reply I got, instantly sending my mood plummeting. Why would I not go and watch her grand final? Why is she being weird about it? Does she not want me there? "What do you mean? Of course I'm going to be there," I shot back. "It wasn't a big deal," she told me. "It didn't matter. It's just a game." We bickered a bit, but finally we agreed that yes, I would be there. It was a great game, even though they lost, but she had to go straight back home after the game for a team function. I just want to say I'm really sorry, she messaged me when her plane touched down. I was really stressed in the lead up to the game. I did want you there, and I'm so thankful for you. There's nothing I love more than knowing you're in the stands watching me. I am so proud of you too. I love you so much, babe. Oh. Get off your phone, doll. Go and enjoy the night with your teammates, I replied. Have fun. I'll chat to you tomorrow. Love you. When she called at 11 a.m. the next day, I could tell something was up. She seemed distant, her words clipped and short, and she didn't seem to be engaging fully with the conversation. We spoke about her night. Yeah, it was good. I had the best time. But I wanted to plan out our next moves. While the ongoing pandemic meant we didn't know exactly when she would be leaving to go back overseas, we knew it would be soon, and I wanted to see her as much as I could before she left. But my top priority was organising my kids. I don't mean to throw this on you, but I obviously want to come up and see you and your family before you go. Oh, we don't need to decide that now, she interrupted. I know, but if you're leaving next weekend, I'm going to have to come sometime this week. Have you heard anything more about it? She cut me off again. We'll talk about it later. Ouch. Sorry that I want to see my girlfriend before she moves overseas. What the fuck? Well, I thought I might bring the kids up too. They love you and they'll want to say goodbye to you too. Silence. I've got to go. I've got things to do. We'll talk later, okay? She hung up the phone, leaving me stunned and angry. What had just happened? Why was she acting so weird? I needed to know. That was a bit rude, I banged out in a text message, frustrated that she'd apparently gone cold after telling me how much she loved me only the night before. Her reply was the last thing I expected. Look, I can't do this anymore. What the fuck is she talking about? I was floored. Less than 24 hours prior, she'd said how much she loved me, appreciated me, wished she was in bed with me instead of going out with the girls. A few days earlier, we'd been holidaying with her family like we'd been together forever. What the fuck had changed? Was she freaking out because I suggested that I bring my kids, whose life she'd been in for nearly 6 months, up for a few days to farewell her? I was completely dumbfounded until I found out that her departure to go overseas had been booked for the following week. She knew she was leaving, and I figured she must have wanted to cut it off before she was gone. The morning after, the country went into lockdown for the first time. I was a fucking wreck, and I couldn't leave the house, couldn't see anybody. I was broken and distraught. This was the third time I'd let her back in, that I'd told my friends and family we're back together, that we were solid this time. I'd been on a holiday with her family only a week earlier. I could see our future, so to have her say that it wasn't working was heartbreaking. There was also a bigger picture for me. It wasn't just another relationship breakup. She was supportive of me going public with not only us, but with my sexuality. It was in the newspapers. It was all over the fucking internet. The speculation over my sexuality and my split with Jared had been going on for a year, and now I was finally in a position to feel safe enough to share some of that. Me posting a photo of us on social media affected my life far more than just, hey, here's me with a new partner. I'd announced this huge life change, not just to strangers, but to my family, my friends, my colleagues. I was coming out to the world. And 3 days later, the relationship in which I felt secure enough to make that move was no longer. I was ashamed and deeply embarrassed. As the weeks in lockdown dragged on, I was inconsolable. I learnt through mutual friends that her move had been put on hold indefinitely. The world had stopped, travel was off the cards for everyone, and there certainly wasn't any professional sport happening, so she was stuck at home as I was in Melbourne. Except, of course, for me, my world was collapsing around me for a million other reasons. Articles were still circulating online about us. I was getting emails from magazines and radio stations asking for interviews, not just with me, but my girlfriend too. They had no idea we'd broken up just days after I posted that happy snap. I was hysterical. I wasn't eating. I was hurting myself. And I was calling her constantly on FaceTime, begging her to tell me why she didn't love me. "So if people break up all the time," came her response, "you'll be fine." I wish I could say that this is where I was brave enough to cut the cord, where I stopped putting up with the uncertainty, where I finally picked myself up off the floor and came back, better than ever. And I did try. I really did put up a good fight. She was trying to explain herself when her apologetic texts rolled in, but I refused to answer. She would call me, but I didn't pick up. I declined FaceTime and I ignored replies to my stories on Instagram. The state of my mental health insisted on it. "I'm sorry for what I said. It came out wrong," she would message me. "I didn't actually mean that. I was just emotional. Please, Soph, just talk to me." She called Jared, asking for advice. "You can't keep doing this. If you're coming back this time, you are coming back for good." "Yes," she apparently told him. "I love her." That might have been what broke me. I could sense real remorse in her messages, and I could see how hard she was trying to get me back, the lengths she was going to, the effort she was putting in. Even someone from her family network reached out to me, asking me to give her another chance to simply hear her out. She was a mess, they said. They'd never seen her like that before. I'd been so strong, held out for so long. A part of me knew that if I caved, I'd end up back in her arms and then probably regret it. But I had so much respect for the person from her side who'd reached out, I didn't want to ignore that plea for help. "I will respond to you, but I have a lot of things to say, so just let me do it in my own way," I typed out in a text, hitting send. "Thank you, that's all I needed," came her instant response. "I just needed acknowledgement." Doing it my own way turned out to be writing a 7-page long email listing my concerns and feelings, asking all the questions I'd felt had gone unanswered in our breakup. The next time she called, I didn't ignore it, and we ended up speaking on the phone for 6 hours. She opened up to me about the challenges she'd been facing, how her world had changed in lockdown. She realised how much she valued my support. The country was still in lockdown at this stage, but she joked that she might come down to stay with me for a little while, and we had a bit of a laugh about it. 2 days later, she'd packed her car, driven to Melbourne, and moved in with me and my children. Chapter 19. As much as I might criticise her, I had been putting somebody else in a very similar position at the same time. It was such a brutally confusing time for me, experiencing the turmoil of those emotions, yet simultaneously doing the exact same thing to someone else. It wasn't in my nature. I'd spent my entire life an empath and overly compassionate, but somewhere along the line, I had become okay with what I was doing. You see, at the same time, I'd been back in contact with my blondie, the one I'd left again only weeks earlier. We weren't back together, but we had reconnected. We were hanging out a bit, talking on and off here and there. But when the breakup makeup cycle kicked off for the millionth time with my interstate girl, I put a stopper in it. I just couldn't deal with having this amazing girl in my life who I knew loved me, who had proven time and time again she'd show up for me while I was navigating what was going on in other parts of my life. So I called off yet another brief reunion before it got serious in an attempt to figure my shit out for what felt like the 500th time. I didn't outright say that it was because the other woman was back, because technically she wasn't. I explained that now wasn't a good time for us to reconnect. I needed to step away before it became serious, before I risked causing even more hurt, even though I still managed to inadvertently do exactly that. While at times it probably appeared that I was treating her badly, I believed I was doing the best I could with the situation I had found myself in. I spent a lot of time trying to forgive myself for being in love with two people at once. Yes, it was highly complicated, each of them offering different levels of compassion, desire, and fulfillment for me. The reasons I loved them were polar opposite, too. Feelings don't have an on-off button, though at times I'm sure we all wish they did. I was stuck in a place of loving someone who, looking back, I think didn't necessarily deserve their love at that time, and someone whose love I most certainly didn't deserve to receive. Part of me did weigh up if it really was love for either of them, or if it was infatuation with the uniqueness of the situation I was in with both of them. Going back to my theory and beliefs surrounding monogamy being a social construct, I was in favour of the notion of having love that overlapped for multiple people at once. And during this entire period of my life, I was never dishonest about where my feelings lay. As someone who had always maintained full control in her relationships and who had lived a significant chunk of her adult life responsible for two children, I was deeply attracted to not having to take the lead with one woman. She was just as sure of herself as I was, and it was hot. The confidence and the presence were inspiring. She was the type you'd compliment, tell her she looked good, and she'd reply, "I know." She was the boss, and I loved not having to play that role. And I loved her playing that role for me. An entirely new relationship dynamic. It was refreshing, spontaneous, and fun. Her certainty contrasted with her deep loving side, always taking moments when it was just us to look into my soul and tell me how grateful she was for me and for my support of her, and how much she really did love me. She was financially set too, not that I needed her money, I earned double and then some myself, and I certainly didn't need her profile or notoriety. But the way she could look after me was something I hadn't encountered for a while. There was a real 50-50 balance in the life load. Someone who was equally as generous and who spoilt me, just as I had done for those I loved for so long. It was nice to feel comfortable in that sense, to not have to always be the one worrying about the money. She was always leading the charge with dinner bookings, making plans for us, holding my hand, walking out in front as we moved through the crowd. But being comfortable being openly gay was super reassuring too. I could finally be exactly who I wanted to be with her, and she was proud of me in everything that I did. But it was the chase for me too. She was my drug, and I was addicted to her. Though I knew at times it wasn't healthy, I was addicted to the highest of highs I found in her, though I ignored the come-down lows. The other woman was, on paper, everything I thought I'd want. A true empath like myself, who provided me with nurturing and care that always made me feel safe and accepted, even at my absolute worst. The one you could sit in an empty room with for hours, deep in conversation, and never once get bored. The simplest things in life were fun just because I was with her. She's the one that everyone liked because her positivity, it was so infectious. She would bring joy to anyone she was around and fill the room with an energy that has to be witnessed to be understood. Hilarious doesn't even begin to describe her. How someone so sexy could be equally as goofy and down to earth, I didn't know. My family absolutely adored her, and she always left a significant impression on my children who asked about her every day, even when we weren't in contact, something I could never ignore. She was the one who constantly made me feel appreciated and who was a deep romantic just like I was. Setting up cooking nights or home spa retreats was a regular for us because the thing we loved most was simply being in each other's company. Our sexual natures were so aligned and she always made me feel comfortable to express and explore my desires. And she satisfied me more than anyone else ever had. She hadn't always had the easiest of rides throughout her life, but she wasn't bitter or hard on the surface. She was understanding, always considerate, and she was my calmness. And for all of those reasons, I feared her, because she was so damn perfect. The perfect future, the perfect wife, the perfect mother, for someone who just needed to be set free for a while. It might sound like it was easy for me flipping back and forth between these two women I loved, but in reality, it was destroying my mental health. I wouldn't wish it on anyone to be in this position, not only hurting someone you care about, but also yourself, over and over. There was a constant internal battle raging inside of me. For a while, sure, I knew I was being selfish, and I was okay with that. I am not playing the victim because I willingly put myself in that position time and time again. Having just come out of nearly a decade-long relationship, I really believed I deserved to have some fun, to enjoy my freedom, and to experience life a little. But it became obvious pretty fast that I had real feelings for both of these women. I loved two people, and I loved them for totally different reasons, each giving me something the other didn't. I had someone who I loved from the first photo of her I saw on Instagram, that big, gorgeous smile and the piercing eyes I'd been known to melt for. One who I'd bonded with from our very first FaceTime call from opposite sides of the world. Yet I felt like we just couldn't ever quite make it work. And then I had this other woman, too good to be true, who I knew could give me a happy, fulfilling life. But I just didn't know if I wanted what she had to offer. She was so pure, so nice, and I was petrified to hurt her as well, terrified of making a commitment to another nice person. Would I run again? I'd made a commitment to my nice husband, and that hadn't worked out. What if it happened a second time? Yet here I was again, allowing a person back into my life, into my home, despite the hurt I'd experienced. The plan was for my interstate girl to come down and simply be with me. We'd get through the frightening, uncertain time in this world together. She'd help with the kids, we'd train together, and I really thought it would be good for me to have someone else there with me. We had no idea if or when she'd be travelling again, whether going overseas was off the cards for good or just for a little while, just like the rest of the world. We had no idea what was coming next. So we bunkered down together and played happy families. And it was beautiful, but it was exhausting. We had so much fun together. It was fiery, passionate, and we complemented each other perfectly. But we also fought. Oh my God, the fights. We had always brought out the best and worst in each other, but put us in the same house for 5 weeks, and at times we were explosive. The whole relationship was one of extremes. The highs sent me soaring, but the lows left me in ruins. I can't and never will only blame her either. We both contributed to that pattern. In moments, it mirrored my relationship with my own mother. I kept waiting for something to change, for her to love me in the way I wanted her to love me. With the obsessive, dependent love I gave her, I struggled to accept her for what she was, different to me and all I'd ever known. I can now understand the pressure that must have created. In some ways, we were a match made in absolute heaven. Two caring, loving, independent, career-driven women complementing each other throughout life. But at a deep, fundamental level, we were also the worst pairing possible. We were two alpha females, a combination bound to end in tears. My friends and family constantly asked me why I kept going back to her, even though our breakups left me so hurt. But this was exactly it, I realised. There was something about the rush of emotions, whether they were good or bad, that I found so appealing. It felt like whatever she wanted to do, we did. Whatever she said, I agreed. If she wanted to nap, we napped. If she had had enough of me and wanted to sit on her own upstairs, I'd sit in the lounge room waiting until she was ready for my presence again. None of this was through force or coercion ever. I was simply happy to be her willing puppy dog. I remember telling a friend once that I idolised her. "That's not a good thing, Sophie," he said. "You've put her on this pedestal. Now you're losing yourself." But I'd make excuses. I insisted that I liked this new dynamic, and I did, I truly did. I liked not having to make all the decisions. I liked not having to shoulder the financial pressure. I liked having this really independent person who was the boss in her own right, someone who really had her shit together. I couldn't see at the time just how much of myself I put aside to be in this relationship. "I'll change to be who she wants," I would tell myself. During our time living in lockdown together, our longest stint of dating without breaking up, I had completely changed. I was no longer Sophie. I compromised on everything I held dear, on the things I would and wouldn't stand for in life. What's worse, I convinced myself that I needed to be this new, dulled-down version of myself in order for her to stay, so that she would keep loving me. In situations where I'd normally question what someone was saying, I held back. In the moments I wanted to jump and scream with excitement, I fixed my face into cool composure while fist pumping inside so as to not be embarrassing. In the end, I spent so much time trying to be something I wasn't that I had no idea who I was anymore. I knew I wasn't me, far from it. But I loved her, and she loved me too. And that was all I cared about. I never thought I'd say it, but after 5 weeks of us living together in lockdown, I was so happy when she left. I just wanted my space back. But not a week later, I was on my way up to see her again. We travelled back and forth like that for the next few weeks, always driving 9 hours each way because air travel was still on hold. I was getting trolled mercilessly online. "Oh, look, she's taken off on her kids again." But anyone who's a mum knows that leaving your kids for a week, 10 days at a time, isn't an easy thing to do, even with several FaceTime calls a day. I'm not sure if she appreciated the toll it took on me, being so far away from my children. But again, I unfairly expected her to understand, despite motherhood being something she hadn't personally experienced. She was dealing with her own shit too. With the halt on sport and travel, her career was up in the air like never before. But as a world-class athlete, she still had offers coming in from overseas teams. God, I was so proud of her. But I also knew it meant that she could up and leave at the drop of a hat, jetting off to a new life in Paris, London, or anywhere else in the world. It wasn't an easy time for her, but I cherished playing that role of emotional supporter, and she'd always express her gratitude to me for being there for her. I was there for the tears, for the hard conversations, the arguments and the stress. I was there by her side when at times contracts were uncertain. It was always me. I was on that roller coaster with her. When she felt low, I felt low. When she had a win, I had a win. I wanted to be her peace during a very emotionally fraught time. She was close to signing on to play with a team overseas, and when her contract was announced, I felt she had already started to distance herself from me. I suppose she might have been doing it knowing that she was about to move, maybe hoping to make things easier on herself, on me, when she did eventually go. We hadn't overly discussed what would happen when she left, which was probably to our detriment. It was a lot to process for both of us, so we didn't. We stayed in our love bubble, mostly ignoring the inevitable. Sure, we discussed a few different scenarios, a few ways we might work the situation, but we never came to any kind of decision regarding us or made any plans. But how could we? With COVID-19 having only been around a few months at that stage, we didn't know yet exactly how the world was going to change. Would things be back to normal by Christmas? Would we be 5 years on, still not allowed to travel internationally? She didn't like to make decisions without all the information, so I knew not to push her on that, even though it was killing me not to have any clarity about the future. At the same time, I didn't know if I wanted to commit to a long-distance relationship with someone I might not see for another 2 years either. I knew that I loved her unconditionally and that the thought of losing her was a living nightmare. I couldn't fathom a life without her, even if that could only be speaking on the phone from opposite sides of the world. It's how our relationship started. Could I do it again, possibly for years this time? All I knew was that I felt stuck in Australia. I felt imprisoned in my own life. I had two kids, and I couldn't leave. At that point, I would have given anything to be able to pack my bags and move with her in that instant, but that just wasn't ever going to be an option, and life circumstance was a difficult pill to swallow. I feel ashamed admitting this, but for the first time in my life, I regretted having my children, and I really struggled to come to terms with that feeling too. I love my kids so much, and I wouldn't give them up for the world. But I was experiencing this bitterness towards the life I had signed up for, and it was a real shock to the system. If I didn't have kids, I could be traveling with the love of my life right now. If only I didn't have my kids, I could follow her everywhere. If I didn't have my kids, we could be together. Those dark thoughts were so invasive, and they plagued me. I felt like a horrible person and a terrible mother. It wasn't my kids' fault I was in this position, but it was the first time as a mum, as a woman, that I felt any kind of regret for the way my life had panned out. While I was facing my internal struggles, she seemed to be doing fine. That's how it appeared to me. I suppose, as a professional athlete, she'd grown used to saying goodbye to family and friends, to having teammates who were best friends one season and then living in a different country the next. And I wondered if living that way for so long had desensitized her to these kind of farewells. But it killed me further to witness how okay she outwardly seemed with the fact that this, us, could all be coming to a crushing halt. Even in our final days together, she didn't seem fazed. I'd flown up interstate knowing that the state borders would be closing soon and that it would be our last chance to see each other before she left Australia. We went to the beach for a few days, and it was very emotional for me because I knew this could well be the last time, maybe ever, we would have dinner at our favourite restaurant, lie in bed together as we listened to the waves crashing on the sand, share avocado toast at our favourite little cafe. I wasn't crying the whole time, but it really hit me on our last day. We'd said goodbye to each other so many times, but we always knew we'd see each other in a week, 2 weeks. There was always the next meetup to look forward to. How do you say goodbye forever? How do you let go of someone when you don't want to? And I wasn't just saying goodbye to someone I loved. I was also saying goodbye to a future I saw for us together. A future I so desperately wanted, with absolutely no certainty around whether it would ever come to pass. We'd picked out our children's names. We'd talked about marriage, how we would own houses in both cities. She was going to pick out our couch because she didn't like my colourful furniture choices, and when she retired, we'd settle down together in Melbourne. I didn't live in fantasy land. We knew the next few years would be challenging, but we'd had those conversations. I wasn't making it all up. I'm sure she had, at that point in time, envisaged life in the future with me. It was so difficult for me to finally have to face the truth of her leaving, even though I always knew it was coming. To me, she always seemed so composed when all I wanted to do was sob uncontrollably. I couldn't handle her being gone, and I loved her too much to hide that. I admit, she did let some emotions slip through a couple of times the day I left for Melbourne, our last day together. We were sitting on the beach, devouring our last meal of fish and chips, watching the tide roll in because I had to go to the airport to fly home. "I have something for you," I smiled cheekily, reaching into my bag. On a whim, I'd gone shopping that morning to buy a piece of jewellery I knew she'd been lusting after for a long time. She always said she'd buy it for herself one day, for a special occasion, and I often wondered why she hadn't. She certainly had the money to get it. She had a love of designer shoes and bags, just like me. We'd always bonded over our love of high-end brands and loved giving each other extravagant gifts. I knew that since this would be the last time I saw her for who knows how long, maybe forever, I was going to get it for her. I passed over the bag and she pulled out the box, the brand's signature packaging, a dead giveaway for sure. But when she opened it, I could tell she wasn't expecting to see what was sitting there, nestled into the velvety fabric. The look on her face was one of absolute shock. Slowly, she lifted her eyes to meet mine and burst into tears. I'd rarely seen her cry, but now she was bawling inconsolably, hugging me, shaking as she put it on. Oh my God, she loves it so much. "Soph, it's absolutely perfect," she said, shaking her head, tears streaming down her face. I'd never seen her cry like that before. It seemed to go deeper than sadness, though at the time I couldn't put my finger on the other emotions that were tangled up in that moment for her. We packed up our things and made our way to the airport, a solemn mood setting over us. This was it. The border would be closing the next day and wouldn't open again before she left. It was our final goodbye. As we hugged, I was absolutely hysterical. I didn't know what to say. It's not every day that you say goodbye, possibly forever, to someone that you are so in love with. We kissed and we hugged, holding each other for dear life. I know it wasn't always easy. I choked through my tears. But for me, it was always worth it. Her face cracked, tears rolling down her cheeks, the silent sobs in sharp contrast to my breathy cries. We hugged, we both turned around, and we walked away. Chapter 20. I've had a tenuous hold on my mental health for a long time, and I've ridden the wave since adolescence, an unhealthy seesaw between thinking I'm magically cured and wondering if I'll be crazy forever. I recall when I first discovered the release that cutting myself seemed to offer. When emotional pain was unbearable, physical pain would somehow ease it, pulling the focus away from the tearing feeling inside my chest, the reverberating noise inside my mind. I was 13 or 14 when I first took to my own skin with a pair of scissors. I played netball with a girl who would often come to training with large cuts all down her arm. We all knew what they were, but the taboo of mental health back in early 2000s meant that no one ever asked her about it or checked in to see if she was okay. Obviously, she wasn't. I didn't believe myself to be depressed back then, but I was so intrigued by what she'd done that I went home one day and tried it. A pair of scissors pulled from my school pencil case was all it took for me to become addicted to the physical pain I felt when adding fine cuts to my body. It didn't have to be my arms. Down my thumb was a common choice, and into my thighs too. I self-harmed very sporadically throughout my teenage years, a couple of times a year, perhaps, when my train of thought took me to darker depths, a place of no return. I can't comment from personal experience, but I imagine the way I feel about it now is not too dissimilar to the way a reformed drug addict may feel. You don't want to be that person anymore. You know it's unhealthy and that it's not the life you want to live moving forward. But you'll never, ever forget how good it felt. My older sister suffered from severe mental health issues as a child and teenager too. There was always something happening with her. She rode an emotional roller coaster of such extreme highs and lows, and while I certainly suffered from my own demons, hers was a path I never wanted to tread. I did try to talk to my mum about how I was feeling a few times when I was younger, though I felt rarely heard. I think she probably thought I was just copying my sister for attention or in an attempt to get the validation she seemed to be getting. But I could tell very early in life that these intrusive thoughts that made their way into my brain, eradicating all logic, weren't the norm. I knew that I would benefit from some professional help. At the age of 14, I built up the courage to tell my mum one night in the kitchen that I wanted to see a psychologist. Knowing that my parents got my sister the help she needed, taking her to appointments and funding her treatment, I did expect I'd be shown the same support. It wasn't the case, though. I was questioned, told I was fine. "What for?" she responded when I sought help. "There's nothing wrong with you." These kinds of phrases instantly make a person with any mental health issues back down, sending them, sending me, into a shame spiral. But I didn't want to give up. I've always been tenacious like that. It had been the theme of my life so far, and it was no different when it came to my mental health. I had to be the one to take care of myself. So I began dog walking and working casually at a hairdresser, doing small cash-in-hand jobs and saving up my $100 every fortnight for my psychology sessions. But eventually, I no longer could afford to go. Jared was always so wonderful with my mental health. He still is. He has an inherently calming nature, and even when he doesn't understand how I'm feeling, he has the emotional maturity to simply listen. To sit, be, and listen without judgment. I found that such a wonderful trait in a young man. As I've evolved and grown into an adult and experienced being with various different partners, I've come to realize that everyone has their own mental health issues, some more severe than others and some more easily recognizable than others too. While some think of mental health as only depression and anxiety, my own relationship experiences have shown me that mental health struggles can present in various different ways, from not being able to sleep to having difficulty with anger management, irrational decision making, a lack of empathy, exacerbating turbulent situations, seeming to have various personalities, deep-seated insecurities, living in denial, narcissistic behaviors. These are just a handful I've seen in my own relationships. I've also learnt that, while I've always been deeply aware of my own psychological issues, not everyone is privy to what's going on for them internally. Some people are so self-aware, and others are in complete denial. Being on the self-aware side, I know when things are getting bad for me, when my mental health is beginning to crumble. And it didn't take long for it to spiral out of control after my girlfriend and I said our final goodbye at the airport. She didn't leave for overseas straight away. We'd parted ways in early July, and she was still here until the end of August, early September. But the shift in our relationship was instant. It was the last time we were physically going to see each other because the border closed the next day, and she would definitely be leaving the country before it opened back up. In hindsight, I think it was a simultaneously good and bad thing, because there would have still been a lot of back and forth if that decision hadn't been made for us. We were still texting here and there, but there seemed to be a change in the tone of her messages that made it clear to me that our romance was done. I felt she was quickly stepping away, bit by bit, and I didn't want that to happen. Yet I couldn't bear the thought of being ghosted completely. I spent a lot of that time pretending I was okay with the situation when I really wasn't. My mental health was deteriorating as I tried to make out like I was happy, like I was thriving, going about my life without her in it. I desperately wanted to text her to find out how she was feeling, if she had heard yet when she'd be leaving. But she would have seen that as me smothering her. It would have been too much. So I left it. Our messages changed from, "Hey, babe," to, "Hi, Sophie," an apparent coldness seeping into every word. Whilst I was proud of her and her accomplishments, my good heart was further shattered by the fact I couldn't be there for her wins after we broke up. Time and time again, I had been there when she needed me. I'd been there by her side for the many ups and downs leading up to getting her contract, always her number one sounding board. But when it finally came to celebrate, I wasn't a part of that. The night her contract was announced publicly, I received a message from her mum. "We really wish you were here celebrating with us." I poured myself a glass at home and I sent a picture back. "Me too. I bet you're all excited." It was a beautiful moment to be recognised and included by her mum, but it was the painful last nail in my coffin. I had her mum thanking me, saying she and the family wished I was there with them, but I didn't hear anything from her about it. Credit to her, she stuck to her word and still assisted me with a media project I had planned months earlier, a short series of interviews with high-profile people to share on my social media. We filmed this episode having not spoken a word to each other in weeks, only communicating via my assistant on email. That day was painful, and whilst my professionalism allowed me to hide my racing, broken heart during filming, I was still proud of her in that moment, and I admit, I got a little pleasure when she seemed to nervously fumble her way through some of her answers. But at the time, I was lying about how I was going, and it wasn't all because I didn't want her to know how I was feeling. It was because it hurt more to imagine that she didn't care. By the time September rolled around and she left the country, we weren't speaking at all. Weirder still, everyone thought we were still together. People assume we ended things when she left Australia, but it was over much, much sooner when we'd said our final goodbye at the airport. I had an epiphany some weeks later when it occurred to me that those tears she'd shed when I'd given her that gift on our last day together may not have been a mirror of my own devastation, but something else. Of course, she may have been genuinely sad over the course of events, but the look I'd seen in her eyes as her gaze drifted back and forth between me and the jewellery box, that emotion I couldn't name at the time, in hindsight, I now believe it was guilt. She had known in that moment that we wouldn't speak again, I think. I truly believe she was crying because she felt so bad about what was about to unfold. So now I was alone, in lockdown, nursing a broken heart, and I was in a really dark place. I was a vision of depression. I would sit for hours on end outside in my courtyard, grossly smoking cigarettes until 3 a.m., staring at my washing that had been hanging on the line for 2 weeks, untouched. I didn't have the capacity to bring it in. I didn't want to go to bed because it would mean I'd just have to wake up and do it all over again the next day. We were in the middle of this horrific COVID-19 lockdown. There was nothing to do. And I was completely lifeless. I missed her, yes. But I also felt so completely abandoned. I wasn't suicidal because I felt like I was dead already. I didn't need her to tell me that she loved me. I didn't need her to tell me that we'd figure things out, that we'd get back together. I just needed to feel as though she cared about me as a human, as someone she'd once loved. I wanted her to ask if I was okay, to show that she cared about my well-being. That's all I wanted. What was happening in Melbourne at the time definitely played into my emotions too. Our whole world was fucked. Unless you're in Melbourne at that stage, you can't understand, and maybe that was part of it. She had no idea how bad that time was. No understanding of how much I would be suffering, imprisoned in my own home for so long. Living as a single mother day in, day out, with no face-to-face connection with anyone else. Trying to do the very best I could for my children whilst drowning deeply in the emotional abyss. I suppose I shouldn't have expected her to be able to hold me through that time, not just because we weren't together, but also because I don't think she ever quite knew how to help me. She always valued my nurturing skills, how I'd cook for her, taking into consideration her dietary requirements as an athlete. The menu usually consisted of salmon and crispy potatoes. Even the way I'd offer to make phone calls for her if she was feeling nervous. But she told me right from the get-go that the way I was so open with my emotions scared her and she didn't know how to handle them. Being confident to share and show my feelings no matter what they are, love and happiness, disappointment and sadness, anger and fear, is a quality of mine that I've always owned. I never shy away from discussing how I feel, even if I know it's not going to be looked at favourably. It's how I live my truth, and I wouldn't be me if I didn't do it. It's part of my personality that I know is polarising to some, but admired by many, too. Speaking your truth often comes with negative connotations, people think you're a loudmouth or argumentative, obnoxious and stubborn, but that's never been my view. I've always preferred to be brave enough to be disliked for who I was than to be liked for a watered-down version of myself just to blend in to a comfortable crowd. Having deep and meaningful conversations that allow space for more than one perspective is something that fuels me. One of my favourite things to do is sit around with a few gins and discuss anything. To learn the different ways people think and delve into their personal insights. For me, there's nothing more respectful than when you can say to someone, "While I don't agree with that view, I find it really interesting that you think that way." I find it quite humorous that we now live in a generation that has come so far in accepting people's unique and individual looks and lifestyles, but there's still so much contention surrounding the fact that our minds work so differently. That was always an issue we faced. Suppressing my emotions, needing to be heard and acknowledged, and not having that need met definitely played into my mental state as the days ticked by and I remained alone. I wanted to speak to her, but I was too scared to rattle her, to make her anxious, so I kept it bottled up. But I was dying inside. I didn't want to move on, and if that made me weak, then fine, but I wouldn't dare to admit it. Is this what true heartbreak feels like? I once thought I knew, but this onslaught of emotions was new for me. Meanwhile, my 30th birthday was creeping ever closer. Never mind that I was heading into a new decade, a new life stage in lockdown. I was also coming to grips with the stark difference between what I thought my life would be at 30 and the reality of what it was. "You've got kids, you've got a good life, you should be happy." But I was getting divorced. My girlfriend, the love of my life, had left. She was gone and I didn't know if I was ever going to see her again. "But it's your birthday, you're turning 30, you're meant to be happy." But my heart really wasn't in it. But nevertheless, I planned an elaborate night with the kids to celebrate, where I dressed up as my favourite performer, Mariah Carey. Another thing COVID-19 had well and truly fucked for me was my 30th birthday celebrations. I had been planning on taking my whole family to the Greek islands mid-year, and the week of my birthday, I was supposed to be in Las Vegas with my best friend, Taylor. The truth of the situation was, I'd been struggling so much that Taylor had moved in with me for a few weeks prior, and she was there with me on my birthday. We'd met a few years earlier at footy, and at the time she was 19 years old, and I was 27. So we were at different life stages of our lives, but somehow we still hit it off immediately. Our personalities are so intrinsically similar. We just get each other, and she has been the most loyal, supportive friend to me over the years I've known her. She's proven to me that age is no barrier to a good friendship. She's the type of friend who notices the little things, celebrates you as a person, shows up for you continually, but is also okay to pull you up and question you when required. She would message me often to check in. "Have you eaten today? Have you had any water? Let's go for a walk." I don't think I've ever truly explained to her how important she was to me during that time. She was such an integral part of me getting through that period, helping me survive that stage of my life. Taylor and I were sitting outside having a cocktail as the clock ticked over to midnight. My birthday had officially begun. Ding! Taking a drag of my cigarette, I glanced at my phone, lit up on the floor beside me like a warning beacon. It was her. A perfectly timed message wishing me a happy day, but it was so much more than that. She still cares about me? After we'd had no contact for weeks on end, here she was. She was overseas in a completely different time zone, but had made the effort to wish me a happy birthday the minute it ticked over to midnight. I was so grateful, so appreciative, but it hurt my soul because all I wanted for my birthday was to be with her. We talked all year about my 30th, hoped and wished that we'd be in the same country for it. She'd spoken about what she'd get me, which winery she'd take me to celebrate. Despite the obstacles ahead of us, I always imagined she'd be by my side for my 30th. Later that day, my favourite bunch of flowers